Welcome to Radio Free Albion with Tony Trigilio. My guest today is Michael McCauley. I'll be talking with Michael about his newest project, a collection of essays titled The Practice of Walking. Welcome to Radio Free Albion. This is Tony Trigilio, and I'm here with Michael McCauley. Michael's recent book is the memoir The After Death Room, which chronicles his journey through several countries affected by the AIDS epidemic, South Africa, India, Thailand, Vietnam, Senegal, and the U.S. The After Death Room was published by Soft Skull Press, and it won the 2007 Lambda Award for Best Spiritual Writing. Michael holds an MA in Religious Studies from the University of Chicago and an MFA from the University of Washington, and he teaches creative writing in the BA and MFA programs at Columbia College Chicago and Northwestern University. Hey, Michael, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Tony. How are you?
I'm excellent. I mean, I'm okay. If the president would finally level with us about Benghazi, I think I'd be doing a lot better.
Yeah.
Oh, and you know, I forgot to add, Michael is talking to me today via Skype. So I'm really happy about contemporary technology and how Skype allows us to do this, but I'm really depressed that the president won't level with us about Benghazi.
Yeah. I just feel like that has been, it's just gone on and on and on. And, you know, it seems like it would be a simple answer to say that they fucked up.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But you can't be politic nor diplomatic and use those kinds of words, I guess.
And, you know, for a half second when you said, I wish they could just say we fucked up, I thought, oh, he's talking about 9/11 and the August 6th, 2001 Bin Laden determined to strike in the U.S. memo. And I thought, oh, no, you're talking about Benghazi. Right. OK.
Or maybe the Vietnam War, you know, just any numbers of other, you know.
Or the Vietnam War. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Or the arms for hostages. Oh, okay, I won't go any further. Yeah.
Mexican-American War. We could go on, yeah.
Exactly. You know, I was depressed about the Lusitania, but I'm really happy about Skype, and I'll just put Benghazi on a shelf for now. Well, I have to admit, it's a little strange to talk to you via microphone, given, you know, I'm thinking of your latest writing project, The Practice of Walking. I feel like we should be doing this interview while walking along the Chicago lakefront on a blustery fall day.
Exactly. Or maybe since today is today, when BP is finally giving up and admitting that they, you know, made such a massive error in the Gulf and finally are going to pay, you know, $4 billion, maybe we could be walking through the BP Whiting plant along Lake Shore, where I actually will read from that section, which you were nice enough to come to my reading a couple of weeks ago, where I talked about that.
Oh, I can't wait to hear that, because that was a fantastic reading in a really rowdy setting, a rowdy bar, the Holiday Club in on the north side of Chicago. And I mean, the rowdiness was great. It was part of the vibe of the place, and I thought it was just fantastic that, you know, people are drinking, they're you know, they're eating burgers and fries, and they're hooting and they're screaming, and you get up there with your story about walking and the political implications of walking and the BP plant, and essentially it's like, you know, BP is now finally saying we fucked up, and it's right there in your essay.
Yeah, I walked through there during the time of the Gulf spill. And, you know, if you remember, that we could actually see it in the corner. If you have TV, you could see, you know, you could see some sort of image of oil. We're not sure whether it really was or not. I'm just making making us all feel like we were part of it. But
I'll never forget those little inset pictures of the continually gushing oil. It was one of the few times I could say the adjective apocalyptic, and I really wasn't exaggerating, because it felt like, how can we survive all this oil leaking into the ocean?
Right. Yeah. It's sort of like maybe like the CIA having like a torture chamber in Egypt, you know, where they constantly show this guy getting sort of, you know, in the corner of your screen. But I guess we couldn't really ask for that. But
right. Like, you know, before you do that extraordinary rendition, can you hook me up to Skype so I can see how it goes?
Are you being facetious or?
Oh, exactly.
Serious?
I'm being a sarcastic asshole.
Okay.
And I'm trying to imagine.
Okay, you're being usually telling yourself.
Yeah. Right, I'm being myself, and I'm imagining.
No, I just get a look at the sort of the blue pumpkin, and that's all I get to look at. I don't get a look at you.
Right, I should add.
I like that image, though. Where'd you get that?
Oh, thank you. This is what Michael's referring to for the 7 or 8 people who live at the center of the earth and are listening to my podcast right now. This is Michael's referring to my Skype icon, which is a blue pumpkin. Exactly. It fits what we're talking about with BP and the apocalypse. My icon is really Globy from the Pee Wee Herman show, from Pee Wee's Playhouse, and you know, Globy.
Wow.
Yeah, and if Globy were here, he'd say, "Micah, tell me all about the BP oil spill. It makes me sick. I want to throw up."
God, I can't believe you're going back into time. Perfect.
And well, yeah, when you mentioned that camera inset from the oil spill, it feels like it was so long ago. I think just because technology just keeps, you know, that almost seems quaint that we could see something like that now. I mean, the technology has advanced so much, web technology, but you know, that really was just a couple of years ago. But it feels like it was ages ago.
I know it.
And so now you've been working on, I'm thinking of time again. I'm sorry. Now I do my.
I mean, that's an interesting thing you say. I mean, do you feel like time has been made much more elastic or much more, I mean, technology, I think, has affected in some ways our experience of time. And I think it's a little bit of what The Walking is about, is our perception of time and also how by being on the ground, you get a different sense of your body in relationship to, you know, where you live, but also a different relationship with time, which I think is a little bit skewed with, you know, technology or just the pace of our life, but certainly with, you know, having the ability to sort of constantly check information or be on your cell phone and things like that. And so it's an interesting thing that you just kind of mentioned there about time.
And I have a love-hate relationship, I think, like a lot of people do, with this, with the elasticity of time that this is, you know, the technology has produced. Like, on one hand, I think it's just the whole idea that time is cyclical and elastic rather than linear. I feel like advanced web technologies and communication technologies are proving that, and that excites me. And
yeah.
On the other hand, like when I think of your project, the real basic practice of walking, how, you know, that slows time down, and it sort of helps me, I absorb time in a different way. It's not linear either. I think it's actually more, I don't know, with when I think of walking and the essays I've heard you read from in the project, I feel like your approach to time, it makes time more tactile, more concrete. It's like it's something I can touch more, you know, even though I also think it's really cool that I could go online right now and email a friend of mine in Paris, and she's probably there in her apartment getting the email right now, and she can respond to me instantaneously. That's not as tactile. And I don't want to sound like a Luddite, but it's just not as tactile for me.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, you know, as a meditator, you understand this. I think one thing about walking is that you are a little bit more in control, or it's in your own body, where when we use all the various kinds of technology, it it's not exactly in our own sphere of our own mind, our own body. And that may be the thing that sometimes I feel a little nervous about. And just as we need constantly kind of develop this ability to feel time or cultivate perception. I mean, that's the only thing that I'm nervous about. I mean, I want to use technology in all the ways that we were just talking about, but I'm also, as I get a little older, I'm just aware of of my own limitations of perception, and that's what I'm finding that's really interesting about walking, is that I can actually have that sensation of connecting in so many different ways to the world that I have either not noticed or didn't think was possible based on how, you know, I've sort of grown up and lived, you know, and I think that's something that we both understand, having, you know, developed a pretty serious meditation practice, is that suddenly we can travel to Paris and we can, who knows where we can go. But they just have that similarity in some respect, you know, meditation and walking. And of course, as you know, as a Buddhist, the walking meditation gives you that sense of the tactile and the sense of time and the sense of the suspension of time all at once. And you just feel as if you have this amazing potential within your own mind and body. That's fascinating to me. So.
I think, yeah, that potential is fascinating in and of itself, I think, because your feet are on the ground and you're just there. It's just you and the outside world, and there's no intermediate thing like your laptop or your mobile phone or something. It's just you in the world without any kind of mediator. But it's also spiritual, like you're saying. And, you know, Michael's talking about our individual meditation practices, and Michael's also been teaching yoga for quite some time and has a really deep yoga practice. So I know that these things that we're talking about with just the body and the way the body moves through space is spiritual as much as it is artistic for you. And it, you know, it makes me think of, and I'm with that 100%. And then I also, I'm kind of laughing at the part of me that, the part of me that's neurotic and has panic attacks all the time. I remember when I first converted to Buddhism in the mid 90s, I was doing walking meditation as well as sitting meditation, and loved walking meditation in our Dharma Center, just walking around and around in the Dharma Center. And then one of my meditation teachers was like, "Well, you should do this. You should do this in the park. I know where you live. I lived near the Fens, this really big park in Boston. So you should walk around the Fens, and that's where you should do walking meditation too." And it seemed so bucolic and lovely and sweet, but then I thought, "Shit, I don't want to walk unguarded in the park. It's very dangerous to walk like that."
Well, it's true. It's true. I mean, in some ways, some of us have access to walking and others don't. And many, you know, particularly women. I mean, women.
Yeah, exactly.
Just, you know, take out, you know, at 10 o'clock at night and walk. I mean, we both live in Rogers Park, and, you know, Liz really can't. I mean, I just say, "I'm going to take a walk to the lakefront right now." And I can, and you can, and or, you know, maybe it's a little dicey for us at different times of the night around here, but I think about that, and it's such a human need to be able to walk and feel and let the body kind of come back into your consciousness as we buzz around all day long and move back and forth between, you know, different people on the internet and call people and our various jobs. And so I am conscious of the access of this really human action I think we need for our own, you know, mental health and for our physical health and spiritual health, as we just mentioned, you know, walking meditation. So I think that's one of the projects of trying to write this book about walking. And of course, I, as you know, I walk from Rogers Park, you know, our neighborhood, along the lakefront as much as possible through Chicago and then South Chicago, where the access is limited, and then it disappears in the area where there used to be a U.S. steel plant, and then on into Hammond and Whiting, which is where the BP plant is, and then on to East Chicago, and then through Gary, and then on to the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore in Indiana. And you know, there, in so many neighborhoods and areas, there isn't an access to the lakefront, and there's not a lot of park area, too. And it's just, I think it's a sort of subtle protest in the book of wanting to say, well, we need to walk, because this book kind of came out of walking in, you know, good old UK, where everyone walks everywhere and everyone's a hill walker, and you can walk right out of London all the way to the coast or Cornwall or up into the Lake District, where, you know, so much of the walking literature of Wordsworth and Coleridge
and it makes me think of
Quincy and everybody, you know, and then here we don't walk, and you know, it seemed not that athletic.
No, and we sometimes look suspicious when we're walking, you know, like just to sort of outline the map that Michael's talking about, and like where the neighborhood we live in, Chicago, Rogers Park, is on the far north side. And people walk around here all the time. We have a couple, three different elevated, you know, subway elevated train stops, and people are walking all the time. But if you go further to the northern suburbs, or if you go to the southern suburbs, there are places that don't have sidewalks. And, you know, you look like a suspicious character if you're walking, even though it's, like you say, this human need. And so I want, you know, in a second, I want to hear an excerpt from the project. And I also want to just key on one thing you just said about your walk to the Indiana Dunes. That was a walk you undertook from Rogers Park, right?
Yeah.
And that's how many miles roughly?
About 60.
About 60 miles. Yeah, that's so just to get this straight, we're, you know, Michael's talking about part of the project for the book is not only indebted to the UK history of walking, Wordsworth or Blake walking in the middle of London, but it's also, you know, what it means to walk in the US. And I'm going to use a horrible pun right now. He's not just talking the talk, he's walking the walk. And that's I hope that was good, because part of me died inside when I said that pun, and part of me, it felt like
I want that blurb.
It's yours. And you did it. You walked the walk for 60 miles, which is amazing. Michael's going to read a selection from the project, and I just want to make sure I've got this right. The project right now, the title of the book is The Practice of Walking. That's the title of your blog. Is that the title of the book?
Yeah,
right?
I mean, you might as well be. I'm not at that stage. I mean,
I know it's tentative, right?
Every once in a while, you kind of like, let me just think of the title of the book. I think I can handle that, you know, and maybe not all of the words in between, but that sounds fine, you know.
Great.
But this little piece isn't, as I mentioned, I walked through the 2.5 mile lakefront area in Whiting, Indiana, where, you know, British Petroleum is located. And of course, British Petroleum used to be Amoco Oil, Standard Oil of Indiana. It was one of the, you know, Rockefeller initial monopoly. And matter of fact, the Whiting plant was the place in which they invented or began to develop the filling station. So the Whiting plant basically, we get most of the Midwest is getting a lot of oil and gas from the plant. So anyway, it's one of the older plants in the United States. It's the fourth largest one in the United States, but it's not small. Anyway, so this is a little excerpt. I walked on to the outskirts of Whiting with BP's tanks and towers looming over me, figuring the lake was still on my left, so I couldn't be far off from my route, until I came to the intersection of US 20 and 129th Street, and I didn't know if I should turn or go straight. A map would have been useful, but hours ago I'd realized I'd left it and my flashlight at home. By the way, this is at night, it's turning dark. from up close, the distillery towers with their scaffolding of pipes and valves no longer appeared to me as hazardous and horrific, but triggered to my amazement memories of my boyhood fascination with all things mechanical. What was actually taking place in this Dr. Seuss-like surreal world of fossils being turned to gas and asphalt, tires and kerosene, polyesters and crayons? Tar from Canadian boreal forests bulldozed up from their seabeds of 10 million years ago, sucked down into these vats and boiled to 800 degrees Fahrenheit until it became delinked from its carbon brothers and hydrogen sisters. Everything you could imagine came bubbling up those distilleries and siphoned down chutes into your tank and onto the shelves where people in the same stupor I was in an hour ago took them out in plastic bags back to their cars. A black kid went by on his bike, and then in the other direction, a white girl. Their bikes like horses in a pastoral scene of ages ago, where youth fled for their bodies' dreams no matter the distance or risk. Both turned back quickly as they passed in wonder at who this man was in a ball hat marching into this industrial madness. Allies, I thought, as they glided by, their bodies floating over the road, their legs pumping through air thickened by particulate matter. And this nod by my fellow wayfarers gave me a little lift, and I needed one because I was lost. Only one woman back in South Chicago had bothered to meet my eyes and offer a greeting. How the body craves the acknowledgement of others on our separate journeys. To be is to be perceived, as the metaphysician George Berkeley once said. Ahead, I saw a stoplight a quarter of a mile perhaps down the road. Beyond it, there was a growing darkness, and that was where I was headed. As I approached the distant traffic light, turning from green to red, a strange sensation came over me. I looked down, and as I looked up, I actually expected to be now at the light, as if I was in a car, moving in seconds rather than on foot. It had happened earlier in the day, too. Lost in reverie on the lakefront back in Lincoln Park, I glanced ahead and seemed confused as to how little distance I'd traveled. Annoyed, even, like I was back in front of a screen staring down at Google Maps, bored with what I was looking at and ready to move on. Was this the result of walking for the past several hours along a highway? Was this because of 35 years of driving a car, or was this my digitally conditioned mind? The strange perceptual hiccup reminded me of an anecdote from Mungo Park, the 16th century British explorer, who was befuddled when his Mandinka porters refused to move one morning after several days of travel at the start of his quest across the savannas of Mali. When he threatened to beat them, his interpreter said it wouldn't do any good. Infuriated, he demanded to know why these perfectly healthy men refused to budge. The interpreter told him, as if speaking to an idiot, "Sir, they wait because their spirits need to catch up with them."
Thanks, Michael. That was Michael McCauley reading from his new book of essays, In Progress, The Practice of Walking. And you're listening to Radio Free Albion, and that piece that Michael just read, I do remember clearly, you know, hearing him read that at the Holiday Club, as I mentioned earlier, this club on the north side of Chicago, and essentially a rowdy bar where a number of us were drunk, and he gets to, not me, but a number of other people. I mean, I could have been, but when I got up to get a second drink, I realized that I didn't have enough hands to bring the water back to Liz and a drink back to Michael. So I thought, one drink is fine for me. It was just, you know, practicality.
I'm sorry. I didn't know that I prevented you from having another drink. So.
Oh, no, it was fine. It was fine. It was probably good for me. Like, you know, it was $10 for a whiskey or something. I'm like, oh, I'll save my money. And I loved how when you were reading this, everyone in the bar just, as rowdy as everybody was, after like about 30 seconds, there was just this sense of vibe of, oh, shut up and listen to this guy read his essay. This is really good. And it's really hard to get a bar crowd to stop and listen to, a piece of creative writing, and not just stop because they want to be respectful, like, hush, hush, this is literature, but stop because they really want to hear what you have to say. You know, even when you You mentioned Mungo Park, the 16th century explorer, and I'll never forget how you stopped yourself and said, you know, everyone's read him. And then, everybody laughed, and then you paused another beat, and you said, well, I have, and then you kept reading.
Well, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Senegal, and I remember I had heard about him there because he was one of the first, you know, European explorers in West Africa. So that's where I lived. And partly in this book, I do have reflections of walking in the savannas of Africa, because that's really where I learned to walk in a way that was a way to kind of get into, you know, my body and get out of my mind and my anxieties, because I was very troubled with what I was doing in the Peace Corps there, and didn't have any idea what the fuck I was doing, and these people were very serious about, you know, what I was going to provide for them and everything, and I walked all the time. I just would take off, and so I kind of remember that in my body as a way to deal with, you know, depression or sadness or fear or whatever.
And just to add, like, isn't that sort of what the part of the Peace Corps experience is for you, if you're the volunteer, to be there and not know what the fuck you're doing?
Right. Pretty much that's for the objective. Yeah, right.
Yeah, I know, and I mean, and I know that it's, and I'm this not, it's not obviously, I hope it's obvious that's not a dig at the Peace Corps. It's really that, you know, you can't really go there with a plan that you're imposing. You have to go there and just sort of figure out what the community wants, if they want anything, and what they need, if they need anything, right?
Right, right. I mean, you know, yeah, I mean, and that's a reference to how much you know, learned about the Peace Corps, you know, from Shelley. And so I think a lot of people in the Peace Corps has this ideal and all of these things, and it can be condemned and it should be challenged. But that idea of going into a community and assessing, you know, what life is like there, what's going on, and who is who, and what can be done, and what shouldn't be done. I mean, was something that they encouraged. So I did go walk around for quite some time, you know, going on. I'm just assessing the situation.
It's assessing, right? Or, you know, you could call it assessing.
I would tell them, you know, constantly, what are you doing today? Well, I'm going to walk around and check these other villages
out.
And
I'm going to assess, yeah.
I'm assessing. I actually make a map for several weeks. And you know, when I finished making the map, I thought, God damn, now what else am I going to do? You know,
but I can make a really hell of a good map. But now what?
Oh, I did. I made a really nice map, yeah.
And I it's, you know, we call it assessing. It's also, I think, what you'd call in Zen, going with beginner's mind or I don't know mind. What are you going to do today? I don't know. I don't know mind. Well, tell me. Yeah, I'll assess. I want to, you know, in a second, I'll want us to close with another excerpt. But before we go there, I was just thinking of a sort of undercurrent of what we've been talking about today and about the body of your work in general, you know, including this project and the After Death Room and most of your other writing. You know, undercurrent is that writing and political activism and politics, they go hand in hand. You know, like in the After Death Room, the subtitle is Journey into Spiritual Activism. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, and more specifically, because that's a broad question, you know, I'm thinking, you know, a lot of other writers we know, it's all, and this is a generalization, but for a lot of writers, writing is just sort of like, you know, art for art's sake. And I know you're someone, and I'm someone who feels this way too, that you just can't do that. That's like masturbation. I mean, maybe that's too extreme, but to me it feels kind of that way. And that you have to always be engaged in the world. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about maybe why you think, you know, writers sometimes resist an activist impulse, or maybe just what draws you to being someone who combines activism and writing.
You know, it's sort of like what Orwell said, in that he, you know, grew in an age when activism was demanded. But I kind of feel like that's every age. But there are times when we see things happening in our lives and in the world, and we just have to respond with whatever we have, whether we're a writer whether we're working in the health profession or you know, parents or whatever we are. And I think that sometimes people don't understand what activism is, in the sense of it's a big word, or, oh, I don't do that much. But it's almost as if we need to be kind of trained to understand that activism is all these little things, all these little responses that just happen. And sometimes I think that, you know, writers are doing maybe more than they think they are by just observing and using beauty and ideas to slow people down and think and feel. And it's like your great mentor Ginsberg is just try to make people cry, you know, and feel and be alive, you know. I mean,
and what is
so
it? He once said he wants to expand the range of consciousness. I mean, if that's not activism, as you say, I love your definition, just responding with whatever we have. And for someone like Ginsberg, that meant expanding the field of consciousness. That's a mode of activism, while also trying to write beautiful poems.
Absolutely. And just to connect, I think connect with where we are. I mean, part of the walking book is it came out, I suppose, the after death room, where I went around and sort of interviewed people living with HIV and activists who were responding to it, where they were. I mean, I learned that over and over again, that you had to deal with people where they were. You couldn't moralize, or you couldn't, you know, try to, you know, get people to do special things. You just had to work with people in their own needs.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that with teaching too. I mean, sometimes you think you've got this grand idea for your class and you're going to do all these things, and then you realize, well, it's not working. So what can I do as a teacher to engage and to bring, you know, some inspiration to the class with what's going on? And you never know what actually will happen. It will come to you if you're awake, you know.
And that's, you know, I was thinking of teaching as you were talking about activism and writing, that teaching, I think, is another mode of activism where you respond with what you have. And that's, you know, your students and the subject matter and getting them to wake up. You know, I even my whole question actually about my distance I want to keep between myself and art for art's sake. You know, where did I get that from? Having teachers that demanded more from me, that, you know, past teachers who said, yeah, you can write a beautiful poem, but, you know, where the fuck is that in the world around you? If it's just in your own head, or if you're just navel gazing, what does that do? And so I think that's where, as teachers, we want our students to make good art, and we want them to be awake too.
Exactly. And to open up their eyes to see all kinds of images and connections that they can make with people and their families and their neighborhoods, so that they can, you know, use language to sort of open other people's eyes around them, and not just, you know, passively accept their roles in this world. I mean, these days I feel like young people are overwhelmed by consumerism and technology, and you know, I feel for them, because I think we're a little older and we had a chance to maybe do other things or try the things without being overwhelmed so much by, you know, these forces around us.
Yeah, we've developed a way. We're a little older. We can filter out the enormous text coming at us all the time. And
I that's what I think. I mean, that's why, you know, we talked about technology early on. I mean, well, I think we had lots of chances to kind of, well, I'll use this, I'll not do that, oh, this is kind of a waste of my time. It's, you know, and over here I really need to keep doing this, I love doing that, I really love to read, you know, books, I need to, you know, take walks, whatever the kinds of things that you need to do in a kind of healthy way to be engaged with the world on multiple levels. And I worry about younger people, because I don't know if they have invitation to that as easily as perhaps we did. But maybe it's because we had good teachers and, you know, parents and people and things that got us out in the world too. So I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know either. I mean, I think sometimes I get really cynical, to be perfectly honest. Sometimes I get really cynical, and I think, how can someone who's just like born in this born into this cacophony of language, how can they filter it and how can they shape it and make sense of it? And then other times I wake up and I'm totally optimistic about it, and I think, well, because of the teachers that they have, and because of just because of the ways the world is shaping them to live in technology, they're finding their way. And I think, well, my teachers probably looked at my generation and said, I feel bad for these kids. How can they do it? You know?
Right. Yeah,
so you just get up and teach your class, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was just reading this thing the other day. I was reading some of Borges and about the chapter on the metaphor, and I mean, it's just old Aristotle, but it was just the idea that, you know, images and metaphors come from where you are. And we point that out in teaching every once in a while. You kind of go, oh, this metaphor works because it's about, you know, you're using your mother and you're talking about your mother in the poem, but you're using her sewing machines or whatever that she has around her as a way to sort of illustrate, you know, this relationship.
And with my mother, it would be like a metaphor of Valium, using what's around you. My mother's Valium. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I shouldn't, okay. But those kinds of things, and it's just being, you know, being awake and aware, and that's something that is something that you have to learn, though, and the idea that you just snap to it and mature, you have to really, you know, learn to be perceptive, I'm hoping that our writings can help do that. I mean, certainly, you know, walking in my own city, which is, you know, the natural world is the natural world everywhere, and kind of that's one of my, you know, pet peeves too, that the cities and even in industrial areas are beautiful, and there are ways in which you can be awakened to the amazing sort of perceptual fields around us, you know. So that's some of my project here.
I've spent a large chunk of my adult life in urban areas, and I feel really strongly that urban spaces are natural also. I mean, I'm in a building that was a three-story building created by human hands. And if I lose touch with the fact that humans put these bricks together, then I feel like I'm losing touch with something really organic, even though I'm just staring at bricks. You know, it's
absolutely. And the bricks came from, you know, the sand and the,
yeah,
and everything right around here, you know. And so it's just again, cultivating the perceptual mind that can read into things and go, look, where did all this come from, you know? And it came from the land, it came from the earth, it came from, you know, people, you know, digging things up in the middle of Africa and getting paid, you know, 3 cents, you know, for every, you know, pound of whatever they were digging up. And, but I won't go off on that.
Well, I'm just thinking that's something that my Skype icon, Globy, might say. Like, Michael, of course, these bricks have come from the world. They have come from me, Globy. Well, I want us to close with another excerpt from the practice of walking.
Okay, yeah. This is actually a piece about my mother, and I did a little walk with her on the Appalachian Trail. My mother and I walked on the Appalachian Trail a mile, and she, you know, she's struggling with Alzheimer's, and we, my father and I, and we went to Tennessee and did a little, you know, a little bit of vacation a few years ago, and so this is a little section from that, and I'm not actually walking here, but I'm with her in a canoe. My mother's decline had been incremental and hard to detect in my errant returns after years of drifting away from my family and the landscape of my youth. Without tangible means of reconnection, I had no house, no spouse, no children. We had learned over the last few years to relate by way of what needed fewer and fewer words: the weather, their gardens, the birds and animals they observed from their kitchen window. But in the last months, as my family began to plan for my mother's move to an Alzheimer's facility, her face began to appear in my mind before I went to sleep. A flash of fear in her eyes, wanting my help, but not sure for what. It is true, isn't it, that emotions originate not in ourselves, but in the fleshy borders of the family. What is it about sitting in a boat in still water, the sky mirrored and the surface holding you afloat? Where does what you thought the minute before sink? What becomes of time, desire, names, and the things they name? Do they cease to exist if we can't think of how to say them? What becomes of these regions of the mind as the brain wanders away? My mother facing me in the canoe confuses me with myself of 20 years ago, leans toward me and in a voice of concern asks if I was seeing anyone. I'm not sure how to answer, for me now or for me then. I can't decide, so I laugh and change the subject, pointing out my father not far away on the shore. Look, Dad. We wave, though she can't see him. Then she asks in the same voice and same emotional tone as before, are you seeing anyone? A blue heron lifts itself out of the water near shore, all wings and neck, moving over the water like a wave through the air. See it? I point. She turns, lifts her hand weakly to help her find it, but looks in the opposite direction. Yet she sees it all the same, her head turning as if admiring it. Yes, isn't that something? What is she seeing if she is pretending to see it? Is there an image in her mind of a bird, of a blue heron? I wonder as I watch her so alive in her expression, her face bathed in the twilight of the mountain evening. Can wanting to see something, wanting someone else to know that we are seeing something, count for seeing something? Metaphysics, after all these years, finally has its use. I paddle toward the lilies out further into the canyon of trees and the reflection in the water. The second growth forest leaning in from the hills, growing out of the mountains at angles. We drift among their shadows. The lights of the lake cabins begin to glow. The water turns green to black. What's up there? She points to the darkening trees on the ridges around the lake. I look. See those people? She says. There are lights up there. See them? I still look when that strange voice emerges from her mind, eager to report on her findings from a world that works in a way we can't understand. I put down the paddle on my lap. Where, Mom? I look along the ridgeline, and in my looking, in my desire to see or imagine what she sees in her hallucination, I see nothing. There, see them? Her voice is real, reaching out, her body pointing up to the dark mountains.
That was Michael McCauley reading from his new project, The Practice of Walking. Today I've been talking with Michael on Radio Free Albion about this project, and we've also been talking about, in addition to walking, about politics, time, technology, and activism, especially activism as, in Michael's words, responding with whatever we have. To read more of Michael's work, his most recent book, The After Death Room, Journey into Spiritual Activism, is available at most bookstores and, of course, on Amazon. And you can find out more about this book and the recent project, The Practice of Walking, at his website, mikemccauley.com, mikemccauley.com. Thanks again, Michael. It was great talking with you.
You too. Thank you very much, Tony.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Albion. If you're a poet and you'd like to be on a future show, or if you just want to email me and tell me what you thought of today's show, you can get in touch with me at Radio Free Albion, that's one word, radiofreealbion@gmail.com. You can also go to the show's Twitter page, twitter.com/radiofreealbion. Thanks again for listening.